Broadcasting from the business capital of the world, this is the Podcast Business News Network.
Welcome back to the show. We are with the Honorable Grant Venerable, our Professional of the Year. We can also call him Dr. Grant. He's joining us today live once again from beautiful California. And as our Professional of the Year, we're ecstatic that he's here today to talk more. Well, we're going to go into a little bit of his week, but you may know him from his books, his published articles, Art Molecular as well, the molecular expression art that he does. And he's really reflecting, you know, the past few shows on, you know, his life and his memoirs, which, of course, we've been highlighting here throughout the past few months. So welcome back. How are you?
Thank you.
Good to see you, Grant.
Thank you, Jill.
Have you played any piano this week?
Pardon?
Have you played any piano
I need
this
to
week?
Put on my.
That's okay.
Sorry.
No
need to
problem.
Put on a hearing aid here.
That's okay.
This is one of those weeks that made me realize that I'm a fortunate man. I have maintained a combination of my youth, the little kid that I knew years ago, is still alive within me.
Yeah.
And I'm realizing that must be helping me to stay well healthy and put some years under my belt. And I'm experiencing a phenomenon that I could not have known, even when I was in my 50s or 60s. And that if one is around long enough, particularly someone of my intellectual and emotional bent, you learn things that you might not otherwise learn.
Yeah.
And one is the idea of a universe of justice, a universe of unity. And what does that mean? How's that played out in my life? And you have mentioned, yes, I come from a highly educated scientific background, particularly in physical chemistry and chemical physics, which happens to do with the physics principles behind the physical chemistry that I've studied in the laboratory. And to nowadays be able to connect the wisdom of my teachers with my daily life and see how physics and chemical and mathematical principles guide our daily lives.
Yeah.
But because such a small fraction of the population really studies those math sciences in very much depth, most do not see that. Nonetheless, they have been guiding stars over the last several decades.
Really?
And helped me to understand things I'm looking at in plain sight, but nobody else can see unless they not only have studied the math and the science, but have actively seen the analogies, I'll put it like that, between chemical principles, physical principles operating in our society, in people's social lives and economic lives. Now, that's the thing that has not been tapped yet in our enlightened past few centuries of civilization. In fact, one is discouraged from doing that because education, as it has been, even in the best schools, has taught us to get specialized into very even deep categories. So things are in silos, and they don't necessarily communicate. The silos don't necessarily communicate with one another.
Really?
So what we've been deprived of in general education in this society, even though we have an excellent educational system, but that's heretical to even say, because politicians play on the fact that not all public schools work. as well as they should or could. But that does not mean we write them off and call them failures.
That's right.
Or that the students that come out of them are failures. I'm here to put down that mythology that we're hearing more and more too tiresome. It's very tiresome to hear all of that. Let's see if I can get this picture back. Oh boy.
That's all right. I see you. I still see you.
Okay, you can see me.
Yeah, I
can. Let's see if I can get to see me as well. See if I hit the table too hard.
No problem. It happens, I know.
It can adjust the setting. So I'll just sit here and look at what our anyway.
Sure.
I got into some I think sensitive issues last time in my ancestry. And I have a book I just received just a few days ago. And it's called Determined by Robert Sapolsky.
Oh.
And one of my best friends who keeps me up on good books recommended it. It's called Determined, Life Without Free Will.
Okay.
And in reading just the first chapter of it, I'm wondering if free will even exists, at least as the way the intellectuals of the Harvard-Princeton circuit look at it. But I think I should start with a pretty humorous but pretty interesting first paragraph of this book. And it has to do with William James. William James was one of the great professors of philosophy and psychology of the late 18th century, late 19th century, and early 20th century. And he was a founder, really, of a lot of psychology. And he dealt a lot with the philosophy of causality. What causes what? What causes things to happen in our lives? What's the nature of that causality? So it seems that William James was giving a lecture about the nature of life. Let me get my glasses focused here and see if I can see everything here. Nature of life and the universe. Afterward, an old woman came up and said, "Professor James, you have it all wrong about causality." To which James asked, "How so, madam?" "But things aren't at all like you said," she replied. "The world is on the back of a gigantic turtle." Said James, bemused. That may be so, but where does that turtle stand?" "On the back of another turtle," she answered. "But madam," said James indulgently, "where does that turtle stand?" To which the old woman responded triumphantly, "It's no use, Professor James. It's turtles all the way down."
What?
And I wanted to holler when she said that. The turtles all the way down, thinkers, as the fall guy, rather than William James. We add our version because we liked James' beard, and there was a building on campus named for him, but the turtles all the way down punch that has been referenced in numerous cultural contexts, including a great book with the title by John Green. All the versions of the story have a male philosopher king who ever being challenged by an absurd old woman, which now seems kind of sexist and ageist. That didn't particularly register with us then. We adolescent males of our time and place. And then this is the author's voice talking.
Yeah.
And he talks, my wife is a musical theater director, and I'm her rusty rehearsal pianist, generalized golfer. As a result, this book is riddled with allusions to musicals. If my college self, being ostensibly cool, that is, like real nice and keen and cool, referring to William James, had been told that my future included my family and me debating who was the greatest elphaba of all time, I would have been astonished. Musicals, Broadway, musicals. What about atonalism? It's not what I asked for. Sometimes life just slips in through the back door. So anyway, the author is talking about apparently unrelated facts in his life. How does that all relate back to the turtles? Well, it relates to my own life. And what that means is looking at the various unities, patterns that I've seen in life. I've had some stumbling blocks along the way, and I've had to wonder afterward if they were big stumbling blocks, how I survived them, how I actually moved forward to better things. And that gets to the issue of causality. And it depends on who you are, namely how you view what causes what and how it causes what. And that's where I'm questioning more, even this book. Does this author, his name is Robert Sapolsky, and the book title is Determined. Determined, subtitle, Life Without Free Will. I think everyone has a sense of free will. And is that anything like God's will or somebody else's will? And I'm thinking, I'm coming down on the side of what we call free agency, but I won't know until I finish this book which side I'm coming down on. Because when I look at patterns and I listen to what people express as their beliefs about what's happened in their lives, they build up ways that they behave under certain circumstances. Many people in this society have or have had a fear of flying, or even a fear of ships, being on ships, boats. And that tended to come from earlier experiences. Not that they ever had anything wrong go happen on a ship or a plane, but others, as reported in news, of great mishaps, great disasters. And so another factor kicks in, and that's the factor of fear.
The fear
And I realize
factor,
fear plays, I think, the major driving force in life today, particularly as people are just not just fascinated, but they're stunned by what's happening in our political existence. And things have happened before that have been stunning in the nation's political existence. One of those big things was the Revolutionary War, which was horrendous. And there's a series on PBS television that's been running about the Revolutionary War, Ken Burns' latest accomplishment. Well, right away, other kinds of intellectuals began lining up and panning Ken Burns' work, which I happened to watch on the television. I said, this is fabulous. Well, why did I think it was fabulous? And others have jumped up and said, oh, I have questions about this. This isn't all true. That's a usual thing that happens in life and culture. Well, I'm saying I'm enjoying it because it has a ring of truth with my reality, which plugs in to how I ascertain causality and what causes what. So there was George Washington, who our textbooks portray as this nearly perfect, highly philosophical, wise character. Yet in the film and the book by Burns on George Washington was not an altogether perfect kind of a guy. George Washington had his own issues. And one of those issues was slavery. One of his issues was how his fellow colonialists viewed life in the colonies. Many of those colonialists were, let's see, how do we say this? They were loyal to King George III of England, who was like 3,000 miles away from the colonies over in England. And George III was against the colonies. And he sent his armies over here to fight the ragtag battalions of George Washington and other generals. Somehow, miraculously, the United States emerged from that hodgepodge of colonization about causality and what causes things. Well, in looking at bad experiences that happened to me, probably the first bad experience was a sense of loss. I think loss is a real source of badness and sadness in our lives. And I was only perhaps 4 years old. That was way back. I was a little old. I was about 5 years old. Whenever I would go visit my grandparents in East Los Angeles, about 12 miles from where I was living in the west side of Los Angeles, I developed little playmates from children that lived next door to my grandparents or across the street. And there was one little girl than I, and her grandmother and her parents were good friends of my grandparents and my parents. Well, this little girl, as I look back, had some kind of version, a variant of cystic fibrosis. And for her, that meant that she was always having trouble breathing, and she had mucus that would build up in her lungs, and the mucus would kind of run out of her nostrils. And but she was such a happy little girl, such a playful little girl. And I just adored her as one of my playmates. Well, there came a moment of caution, somewhere around 1948, perhaps, when my mother spoke on the telephone with this little girl. Her name was Anne, and her mother. I described this in my memoir as one of my earliest memories. And mother would speak in hushed tones with her friend Lenore, who was the mother of little Anne. And she only would mention that Anne had been in the hospital, but I knew it was a very heavy kind of a situation without mother saying directly what it was. I don't think the adults really knew medically what it was. But then came, there were hushed voices on speaking on the phone. But then there came that time when my mother had to inform me and my sister and brother that little Anne had passed away. And I was so sad.
Oh my gosh.
It established a pattern in my life that was the basis of causality of things I experienced well into adulthood, well into late and into senior adulthood. But this is an example of causality operating in our lives, because as a little child, I built up beliefs about death coming for friends and relatives, not fully understanding what that meant, but very much understanding how the families always responded in the community with such deep sympathy and empathy and support for the families who had lost a relative, particularly a young little child. That is with me even to today. But yet, that episode occurred the same year, earlier in the year, that my father's mother passed away. And that led to another little incident, which is written up in the memoir, Footprints in a Chaotic Unknown. It made me realize all of my unknowns in life have been chaotic. So what did that mean? It caused me to develop subconsciously a response to chaos and unknowns. And because my response was developed in an environment of a loving family and community, I did not take on the fears that tend to hobble the lives of so many who develop beliefs and almost feelings of destitution and anxiety around something we call death. Well, truth be told, experiencing little Anne's death was a preparation for my grandmother's death much later in that year. And I believe that came in October 1950. But it manifested months before her passing, in which my father was bathing all three of us little youngsters in the tub. Our mother was away, so it was his turn to bathe us. And he was a little bit distracted by his mother's condition. As she was getting older, she was about, 78 years old at the time. In 1950, that was a very old age, particularly for someone who was born very close to the abolition of slavery in the United States. But she was born in Missouri, which had both philosophies. It had abolitionists in Missouri, and it had pro-slavement sentiment of Confederate people. That's part of my complex history, which is part of this Footprints in a Chaotic Unknown. And that's what my book talks about, that needs to be understood by children and young people today as they grow up in our schools. I'm watching the current Department of Education charging in a whole nether direction to actually say, well, slavery's too embarrassing for a lot of people, so we shouldn't talk about it and certainly not teach about it. I am so blessed and favored to have had elderly grandparents, other relatives who lived in that period. They did not have to make up stories about something. They lived the stories. And my grandmother, Venerable, was a product of one of those stories that led us to understand slavery was not the cut and dried process and experience that we hear talked about in such simplistic, brutal to most of the people who were captivated in slavery situations where they were owned by other people who were identified as a different race from themselves. Well, I'm also here today to share with all who can hear my voice and see my image that it wasn't all the way that we were notified about, whether it was in the news media or wherever. The lessons that come to you when you get the big picture is that everyone on this earth, exclusive of no one, has a history somewhere in the last, I'll say, 50 years, 100 years, 3 centuries, 1,000 years, 2,000 years, 10,000 years of having ancestors who were brutally oppressed by a group of people that had more power than they did as the oppressed. That is what I have been able to open my mind to, and am now alerting my young students and mentees today. Find out, ask your elders while they're still alive.
It's so,
so that
true.
You can study where you came from and what caused you to be who you are today, at least in the framework of philosophical free will. Well, Grandmother Venerable had such a rich life. Her mother was owned by a couple, which I don't know if I've mentioned that before yet, because it's quite a story. And I've learned more about it in the last, 13 years. From descendants of the couple that owned my great-grandmother. It was because of the generosity of these descendants that I learned a lot I didn't know, even from relatives who were elderly. That has made all the difference in my understanding of a pastime America that hardly anyone knows anything about. It was a couple. The couple were prominent people in the Confederate forces of the United States. The father of this family was a very well-known, celebrated Confederate general. I think of the 9th Confederate Regiment in Western Missouri. They had an interesting, more than interesting, lifestyle. Yes, they were well enough to do that. They were able to sustain servants. And at least two or three of the servants were gifts to the colonel's wife back in the 1860s. How do we know this? We know it from the descendants of this couple, who are the great-great-grandchildren of that couple. And I'm the great-grandson of one of the servants of that couple. So it gives you a more balanced view of life and times, for which I'm grateful. It gives me a pattern to hold on to and say, this is how people really are. Now, the truth of the matter is, this couple were devoutly loyal to the Southern Confederacy and its causes. Well, its main cause, I think, was more lifestyle and culture than the Civil War itself. However, they owned servants who were of another race. At least we thought that was a different race. We know better now. It's all the same human race. They just had different phenotypes and appearances. They had different origins geographically. But they all, in this colonel's family, had one thing in common. They cared for one another. And so the servants were serving from a different state of being of being loyal to this colonel's family and making sure life went well for them. And coming back in the other direction, the colonel and his wife took care of their servants in a way that other owners did not take care of their servants. So I'm saying, yes, there were exceptions to the rule of brutality.
Yeah.
And we know that there was a mythology that developed after slavery that the slaves, the ex-slaves, were to be given 40 acres and a mule, which I think most people may have heard about.
Yeah.
Well, my grandmother, Venerable, got her 40 acres and a mule. So did her mother. So did her sisters and brothers. But it wasn't a literal 40 acres and a mule. It was a little sum of money that the colonel's wife left in the colonel and her will for the servants.
Yeah.
And I happen to have a copy of that will. It is really an amazing thing to behold because it speaks to the universal humanity of all people. No matter what our beliefs have become about certain classes of people, and I'm so grateful for that. Even as I know the whole truth, I know the highs and the lows.
Yeah, of course.
Well, it was through that little inheritance that my great-grandma received from her former owners that was passed down to my grandmother.
Wow.
It wasn't anymore. I mean, today we would say, well, that was nothing. It was like $250
Of course,
in 1918. But guess how much that was worth in today's money?
I can only imagine, yeah.
Enough for my grandmother to
Two.
buy land, which grew crops that
Amazing.
she rented out to people to grow their crops and earn a living. And then after she sold that property through her daughter, who stayed in Missouri for a while, who would send her the profits of the renters on the land, they also, her daughter sold the property and sent the proceeds to my grandmother, who used it to purchase a house in Los Angeles
Amazing.
in the 1920s. That was the house I came into when I was born, and that my father and mother lived in the first 3 years of their marriage, which was a common thing. When young couples got married, they often would move in with the parents of one of them.
Yeah.
Now, I think our listeners are getting a little sense of what I'm
I think
talking
so.
about here
I am.
in creating a bigger picture of who we are as America really still are, irrespective of the images that come through to us on the 5 o'clock news.
Yeah. Oh, that's so funny. So
So
true.
I'm going to let that sink in.
Yes.
Because it's a big piece of my causality in figuring out what causes what in my life. So if I leap ahead, like
sure,
some
go for it, go for
20
it.
years to when I was teaching in my second position and got terminated from that position around 1980, it was such a surprise to me. It shouldn't have been, which I learned later, but it was too late for me at that time in this great university where I was teaching. Oh, I thought that was a terrible thing to happen. I thought it was I thought it was a cruel thing.
Yeah.
If I had thought about it, my great grandparents did not have anything like that happen to them when they were enslaved.
Oh, wow.
But I did, as a free man in America in 1980. And it shouldn't have happened under the rules of academic guidance. But it did. I had to deal with it and did, but it led me to seek out the benefit of human growth, trainings, experiences. And that's what opened the gates, the floodgates, to a fact I had not fully established, is that I am ultimately responsible for my life experiences. Now, that goes against the doctrine of what people learn about fairness. We learn about, well, some things are fair and some things are not fair. I had to learn life is not always fair.
I know.
So that resonates for you, Jill.
It
I
really,
take it.
Of course it does.
But I'm so glad that I learned that, at least for the time I was, about 38 years of age. And so as I went into my 40s, to get it right, and getting it right meant developing something that just happened to me as a result of causality of earlier experiences, I learned how to read my fellow human beings.
Really?
Not always perfectly, but usually I had it right so that I could say, well, I'd better watch out for this person. I mean, they're very nice right now, but something is coming through that tells me I need to watch out. And that was usually the case. So I got terminated from jobs maybe 7 or 8 times. But in those times, I was ready for it. I was actually able to prepare myself and saying, well, I don't think this job is going to work out, so
yeah,
I'll get another job. And I had many jobs, but I had wonderful positions. Some were very menial. I was a cashier in a winery in the wine country. But I learned a lot. I met a lot of people who were tourists, not only from the United States, but from Europe and Asia and Africa, South America, who were visiting California's wine country. So
wow.
One thing built upon another thing. And by 1990, I had got back into university life at San Francisco State University. And that was a learning experience because I expanded my experience of subject fields. I wasn't strictly in the field of chemistry, but I became a devout practitioner of chemical history and philosophy, science history, science philosophy, to be able to trace the development of knowledge and wisdom in the world from its origins. And there were a few origins around. Some were in the great river valleys of the Middle East and India, the Tigris and the Euphrates in the Middle East, the Indus Valley in India, the Yellow River in China, the Nile River in Africa, the Mississippi River, the Amazon River in South America. But that's where our knowledge came from, was the traffic, the people that came down those rivers, and they brought their learning with them from further. I mean, the rivers of Europe that brought their knowledge from Northern Europe and down to the Mediterranean and developed all of the high learning, not all of it, but much of it, along the Mediterranean. We talk about the ancient Romans, the ancient Greeks, the ancient Hebrew people, the ancient Palestinians, the Egyptians. Well, the Egyptians, it was both an African culture and a Euro-Asiatic culture. But the Nile was the only major major river in the country that flowed in the wrong direction,
Really?
according to classical European scholars. You think about it, the Nile flowed from 4,000 miles south of the Mediterranean down in what we call the Victoria Falls is down there. And there were people of very advanced culture there, like several thousand years ago. I mean, like 10 to 12,000 or more years ago. We don't hear about that in our usual schooling. But these were ancient African people that had discovered a lot of principles about learning the flow of rivers, about how to predict the climate, how to use geometry. Well, they developed geometry and brought that learning down to a place that the Greeks called Egypt. And there were many temples along the Nile, religious temples. But those temples studied the laws of nature.
Wow.
And that's really what I want to wind up with, is we have three really classes of laws that we have to deal with. And because people don't understand the hierarchy of the laws, they get very fraught with anxiety when they think the laws are not working to produce the things they want or to punish the people they think should be punished for committing crimes and wrongdoings. And we hear that a lot. We're hearing that about politicians, in fact. They said, well, he or she did thus and so, and they got away with it. So here's Grant Venerable on this podcast saying, oh, no, they don't. Because those laws, the first step that affects us in our everyday lives are civil laws written by governments, legislatures, endorsed by courts, and enforced by executive branches, at least if they're working right. And things kind of went awry that caused the Civil War, that caused the Revolutionary War. But there was a set of laws long before civil laws. They were the laws that we learned more about in our religions. We had things called gods, and everyone had different views of their gods. And it's important to be responsible to your view of whatever that means. I was to mine, still am. But those religious laws they were actually more severe in their punishment than the civil laws. So if whole peoples were violating religious laws about treating other people's right or wrong, they would be punished by things that were written in scripture called earthquakes and the ground opening up and fire, and they'd be pushed into the fire. And then there was the famous story of the Israelites crossing the Red Sea because the waters parted.
Really?
Now, whether or not that was true is irrelevant to the truth that it's trying to convey.
Yeah.
And that's how people in ancient times conveyed truth and beliefs to the younger generations. That's the importance, not necessarily the fact that they occurred or did not occur.
Yeah.
Well, then after religious laws, what happened? From China to Europe, to the Americas, scientific and mathematical laws were discovered that had been around before the religious laws, as well as the civil laws. So I'm here to say that if you do something wrong and you seem to get away with it, well, I've got news for you.
Yeah.
The religious law doesn't catch you, natural laws will.
So true.
The only drawback to that for many people is they don't get to see the consequence of one's actions if they were bad actions. But that's not the point. That really is not the point. You're not supposed to. That's the ego. The ego worries about things like that. The ego wants to see dreadful punishment meted out on real evildoers. But in the natural world, in the natural universe, the laws are actually self-penalizing. So if you violate them, you live in a four-story building, apartment building, and you decide, oh, I think I'll jump off the roof. I'm going to fly. And so you find, well, that doesn't really hold up because
no, it
there's a
doesn't.
law called gravity
It's
that'll
so
get you.
funny. It will
But
get you.
chemistry has laws. And those are the harder laws to understand. Because there's a time factor in chemical laws that we don't have to face as much in physics, even though there's the laws of motions. We do
So
have to
true.
abide by those. But the laws of chemistry govern all processes that people must abide by, or they develop in their own societies. And there's certain time constants that attend to those processes. So it means that time must be accorded to the process. And engineers have to figure that out. So the stories told in my family by my civil engineering father, who learned his civil engineering from one of the greatest engineering and science schools in the country at Caltech. His professor, Converse, and Daugherty were two of the top building constructions specialists in the world. So they were appointed to be consultants on major projects like the Boulder Dam, also called the Hoover Dam, also on all the aqueducts that were created in California to pull water from the Sierra Nevada mountains down into Southern California or into the Bay Area, or those people that designed and built the freeway systems, particularly the interchanges that were so complex.
Amazing.
Okay.
I don't know how
so
the heck,
in my
right?
dad's day, amazing. I remember in Los Angeles, the biggest, most elaborate freeway interchange was the first one designed by a female engineer. And so she was written up in the Los Angeles Times as the executive engineer on the, let's see, what entered, I think that was the interchange between the 405
oh my
and the
gosh.
10 freeways. That was the San Diego freeway crossing over the San Diego freeway from downtown LA. Well, what did my father do? He and his classmates helped do calculations for professors Converse and Daugherty, who were appointed to the Golden Gate Bridge construction. Now that bridge is just simply amazing. It takes my breath away every time I look at it. Because the towers, I mean, the roadbed is like 350 feet above the water, or 300, something like that. And the roadbed is constantly, it's being held up by these suspension cables and these two towers that go rise to a height of like 800 feet. And winds are constantly wafting through the Golden Gate into the San Francisco Bay. So it means that the roadbed of the bridge sways. all the time. It sways a little or a lot, but it has four lanes. I think it's four lanes, eight lanes in each, eight lanes, perhaps four lanes in each direction. It might be three lanes in each direction. I'm not sure. I haven't been over it lately. But the main, where the podium, where the construction had to start, was underwater. And so there was a tower, the South Tower was built in the water. The North Tower was built on the land as it overlapped, as it went out over the water of the Golden Gate. So that meant they had to do special skills to build the South Tower because they had to dig down to bedrock. They couldn't just put it on dirt.
No.
And that meant they had to prepare a cofferdam. In other words, they had to put this concrete dam up in the water and then expel the ocean water out
Yep.
so that you had dry dirt at the bottom of that cofferdam. And that's what my dad helped do computations on, all of that
Yeah.
work to ground the anchor of the South Tower of that bridge. So
Amazing.
that gets in again into the whole issue of causality, our beliefs about what causes what. Because there was a period we thought that Apollo caused the sun to rise and then set, because the sun was on a chariot driven by the god Apollo of the Greek and the Roman gods. And then we learned later, oh, the sun was a star and the earth rotated in a way that you saw the star. It looked like it was rising in the morning and setting in the evening. So that's what science did. It replaced the need for superstitial gods to do that. But we still have the superstitional
Yeah.
gods.
I
And if we
hear
understand psychology and philosophy,
you.
we know how to use the knowledge of them to live successful, healthy lives.
God bless. And we'll have to end it on that note today. Grant, thank you. Wow. How do we co contact you to find out more about the memoirs and to get in touch? Thank you.
Look online at Barnes and Noble's Apple computer, Apple Incorporated, or Amazon, and look up Grant D. Venerable, the second, Footprints in the Chaotic Unknown. Or look on the website.
Perfect.
It's called Grant D. Venerable, PhD, one word, .com. Grant D. Venerable, PhD, .com.
Well,
And
thank you
you'll
so
find it
much, Grant. We appreciate your
there
time here
also.
and hope you have a fantastic Thanksgiving. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you
Same
so
to
much.
you.
Looking
Same
forward
to
to
you,
we'll
Jill, and
chat again next week. Enjoy the holiday, okay?
all of our listeners.
To everyone, happy and healthy.
Okay.
Broadcasting from the business capital of the world, this is the Podcast Business News Network.
Hey, what's up, everybody? I'm Jason Derulo. I love that music connects to people all over the country. But unfortunately, so does something else. Childhood hunger. 15 million kids struggle with hunger right here in America. And yet, every year, billions of pounds of surplus food in the U.S. go to waste instead of going to the children in need. Feeding America is working to change this. The Feeding America Nationwide Network of Food Banks rescues this surplus of food to help provide meals to families in virtually every community in the United States, including yours. But they just can't do this alone. Join me in the fight against hunger in America. For more information on what you can do to get involved, visit feedingamerica.org. That's feedingamerica.org. Together we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America. A message from Feeding America and the Ad Council.